Welcome again to the Write Project Podcast. This is a show about writing and modern Newfoundland author culture here on 93.5 FM or online at chmr.ca. Wherever you're listening from, we're happy to have you. All right, we're here on the Write Project Podcast. We've got Helen Escott. She is a former RCMP communication strategist, and she's also a author. Several years ago, she published a book, I Am Funny Like That, based on her popular book. comedy blog, and this August from Flanker Press, she has got a police procedural thriller set in Newfoundland.
It's a crime thriller.
Yes, crime thriller. Okay. All right, I wanted to talk about the writing process a little bit, just to describe, if you could, without giving away spoilers for this book that's coming out in August, if there's anything that you can talk about with the book in general. What's it about? Where's it and the process of writing it?
The book is called Operation Wormwood, and in policing, every investigation, big investigation, is called an operation. Mm-hmm. So this one is called Operation Wormwood because of that, and it is a crime thriller that's based in St. John's, and St. John's actually becomes a character in the book, and it's about a disease that's called Wormwood that seems to only be affecting pedophiles, and it's kind of stumped the medical community, and they're trying to figure out why it's only affecting pedophiles. So there's a doctor who does the investigation, and then there's a police sergeant with the Royal Newfoundland Constabulary who can't believe that it's a disease that's doing this. He thinks it's a serial killer. And then there's the Catholic Church who decides to bank in on it and say, you know what, God created this disease to punish pedophiles. And so they're sort of jumping on the wagon for it there. So the whole idea of the book is to, I wanted to create paranoia among pedophiles. I guess the whole point of the book was I wanted to create vengeance for victims and create paranoia among pedophiles.
Yeah, which is an admirable goal, I think. It's odd to have, from my point of view, it's odd to have goals in literature outside of just good story, but it is a good story. I'll say that I have read an earlier draft of this because we're friends, and it's a very good novel. It mirrors both, like, it's somehow three different things that we've never had before in popular Newfoundland fiction that is traditionally published. I don't think we've ever had a real crime thriller, like a fictitious crime thriller. Pretty sure we've never had a medical thriller, and I'm pretty sure we've never had a religious thriller, and this is somehow all three. And really, the book kind of becomes, from my point of view, from a culturalist point of view, it becomes like an examination of our culture from the point of view of these three major Newfoundland institutions, the RCMP, the medical community, and the church.
Thank you. Yeah, I cover kind of all of it, and it comes from a career as a civilian member in the RCMP as their communications person. And as the communications strategist for the RCMP for the entire province, my job every morning would start out with reading the advanced report. So every time there's a crime in the province, the police officer writes an advanced report, and it's sent in to the criminal operations people, and then I would be on that team. And you read it to decide if there's a communications or media arm to this, or if it needs a strategy, or if we're not going to go in the media at all about it, depending on what it is. So I noticed early in my career, there would be a child abuse file come in, you know, maybe once or twice a month.
Wow.
And then I noticed that as the years went by, I started reading them, you know, once or twice a week. And then towards the end of it, I noticed that there was one almost every day.
And so this is an escalating problem.
Yeah, and it's the how that happened to surmise there is that because of the internet got more prevalent throughout my career, it became, and police forces started to work together more, that it became easier to find pedophiles who were downloading child pornography online. So, and then investigative skills got better. So we were finding more. So it's not that there were more pedophiles. It's just that investigative skills were better and information sharing among police departments were better, and more pedophiles were going towards the internet and the dark web to download images and videos.
Okay, so I had this image in my head when you were explaining the increasing frequency of there being more and more, not that it matters where the children are from, but more and more local people being abused by this. So what you're saying is that you can now, in addition to finding those people with the birth of the internet, there are more opportunities for people to commit crimes and view images and stuff from all over the world, and you're still catching those. So it all goes in the same...
Yes, yeah. Absolutely. So if somebody from central Newfoundland were downloading pornography, then a police officer in New York might be on a file that's associated with those pictures and would notify the local police that, look, we have a target in your area.
Wow.
So it's because of information sharing among police departments, it's easier to find pedophiles. And also, people themselves are more educated now on child abuse. You know, there was a time if a child was being abused, people would say, oh, you know, don't report that to the police, and you victimize the victim and you let the perpetrator go. And that was common in families. But now
there's an age gap between us, and to me that's just, and you can kind of see the cultural shift across this table, because you're saying that that's the way it was at X point that you remember.
Yeah.
And to me it's alien. To me I'm like, what?
Yeah, thank God for that. And that comes from education, from police forces who are educating and social workers who are educating people now to say, look, no, that's not right. And because your generation now would never do that, you know, now you protect the victim. But that wasn't always the way. So now, because people are more educated, they won't put up with the Uncle Pervy coming in and touching the child anymore, or the grandfather who's been known to touch the children. They won't put up with that anymore, and they are willing to report it. So
Uncle Pervy.
Yeah, Uncle Pervy. Everybody has that Uncle Pervy wants you to sit on their knee.
That's one thing that my generation growing up, like the education tour, I think with every generation now, or even sub-generation, every few years, we learn a bit more about how to talk about these things with our children. I know when I was growing up, while it was much better, there was an emphasis on the stranger danger, and now we know that that couldn't be a more of a false flag, because while that does happen, the vast majority of abuse comes from someone you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because there's a grooming process.
Yeah.
And it tends to be somebody that's close to the family or close to the child. Someone that you trust.
So to bring this back to writing, I suppose, you've got a extensive history dealing with this subject matter. And I think it's fair to say, from talks with you I've had before, that the book is almost, I compare it to Girl with the Dragon Tattoo in a weird way.
Okay.
Girl with the...
Perfect, I love that book.
Oh, I love that book too. I love that whole series. But even the genesis of it, do you know why he wrote that book?
No, I don't.
Without getting on the air like too far into it, he had a rough childhood and witnessed a girl at a very young age being, like, he was at a young age and so was she, witnessed a girl being abused. And even though he couldn't do anything about it, he carried that survivor's guilt on throughout, and eventually he wrote Girl with the Dragon Tattoo as a vengeance of her. Yeah, she became a vigilante based on the girl in the novel, based on a similar experience that then drove her into a revenge arc. It strikes me that it's a little the same for you, but not in the direct, oh, I've witnessed this way, I hope, but more in the, like, you spent many years looking at the files and seeing how prevalent this was, and it kind of going into the back of your mind and saying, like, I wish that X would happen to these people. It's almost wish fulfillment is a weird thing to say, because it's almost derogatory to say that about an author, but I think it is. I think you can take a wish fulfillment thing and then, if it's well written and it's literary, make it profound cultural read. And I think yours is, having read it. I think it's...
Thank you.
I think it's shaped to change our culture a bit in a way, and I'm very, very happy that it's coming from Flanker, because I want to see more. Well, you know me, I'm always on about seeing
local,
more thrillers and stuff like that. More thrillers, more stuff that has a broad appeal that could, even though it's based in Newfoundland, could be sold anywhere. That kind of stuff.
Absolutely, and it came, and I think it came for me was, you know, after years of working, after a career of working in policing, and I'm also a mother, so I'm raising children as I'm reading these files. And they do affect you after a while. They do get to you.
Oh, of course.
And it just, I think one day, I think I just kind of broke there and said, you know, I wish that the next time a pedophile touches a child or something would happen to them horrible to stop this. Like, and I'm also a Christian and I'm a practicing Christian and I'm a very spiritual person. And I do go to church every week and I brought my children up in the church. And I have often struggled with that, I guess, the dichotomy of going to church and believing in God and then going to work in policing, where a lot of your clients are evil people who want to hurt people, especially children. And I would say every week in church, I would often talk to my priest about it or just think about it and say, why Jesus says, you know, bring the children unto me. Why does he not protect children? Why is this allowed to happen? If there's a God, why does he let this happen? So it became a struggle for me. And part of my PTSD is that I had to struggle between my religious beliefs and my policing reality. So I started to write thoughts down. After seeing a psychologist, I started writing thoughts down to say, you know, and she encouraged me to start writing.
Yep.
And so I did. So I started a blog, and the blog was funny because I wanted to concentrate on funny things that happened in life. So that just kept me writing every week. And then I kept a file in my desk drawer of every time I had to read another child abuse file, I would just write down my feelings. And so by the time I retired, I had a file folder full of notes.
Ugh.
So I brought home my stuff after I retired and put it in my basement in a box and left it there. And then, so I'd been doing that for 10 years. So I've been keeping notes for 10 years. So after I got home one day, I was down in the basement. I found the box and started going through it. And because you kind of need a year to, you know, down just to get rid of everything in your head from when you leave policing, you kind of have to have that decompression.
Yeah.
A year away from it. So I found this box and I started going through it, and I found that file folder and I started to read it, and then of course started to get angry again.
Yeah.
And then said, you know what, I'm going to write this book. This is a book and I'm going to write it, and it's going to be a book like no one has ever written before. It's, you know, the every police thriller is about a serial killer. This is not about a serial killer. This is about a disease that only targets pedophiles. It has never been done before. There's no other book like it. There's no other idea like it.
It is amazingly fresh. Like, I know that's a generic thing to say, but I've never read anything quite like it before. It is a original idea, which is in itself, in and of itself, a novelty now. That's almost enough. As it's a very, very well-written book, and I feel like you explore multiple points of view, and it almost becomes, while still being a thriller, it almost becomes a psychological thriller, where it's philosophical in nature, as the heads or the characters from these three different organizations argue it out on what is the best thing to do, and it becomes a microcosm of the issue in general, when it comes to disease, when it comes to thrillers, when it comes to morality, when it comes to a lot of different things. I think it would be enough for it to have been a good new idea, because those are in short supply. It's sad, but they're everything's a remake now, and so what we have with you is this original idea for a thriller, something I've never really heard from before, because you could call it an outbreak story, which has been done. Michael Crichton did a million of them, but it's not quite an outbreak story. It doesn't follow the story beats of an outbreak story to its benefit. I think it's an outbreak story from the point of view of these institutions and the characters of these institutions and the real people. And I think it shows through that you were in one of these institutions, because the characters are very real in it. Like, even if they just show up for a few lines, it's still you get that they're real people, at least in your head.
Yeah, and the characters were the development of the characters were very important to me, because they represent areas of society, and you know, this is not a book against the Catholic Church where all the pedophiles are priests. That's not
no,
the case
at all. No, it's
very
much not.
And it's not. And one of the main characters is Father Cook, who is a Catholic priest, but he's a good guy. He sees this disease and he goes, you know, I've prayed for this disease for years. I wanted this disease because I am a good priest and I do want, you know, families to come back to the church. So he kind of gets caught up in the church capitalizing on that whole idea, and he becomes the face of the Catholic Church.
Yeah, I don't want to go into any spoilers for your book or anything like that. I want people to read it when it comes out August 8th. But it's very much like when we say that the church fictitiously is involved in the story to its benefit. It's not involved in a way that it would be.
I don't attack any organization.
No.
The characters are real and the characters are flawed. You know, like the police officer is based on a lot of good police officers that I've worked with over the years. And there's a whole bunch of characteristics I've taken from people I've worked with who were fantastic investigators and were really good at their jobs. And he is this flawed character.
He is. I was about to say, like, there is a temptation among authors, especially if you come from an institution and they're writing something within that institution. It's like rose-colored glasses,
yeah.
You know? And while there aren't villains from the institutions, it doesn't seem like it's rose-colored glasses. It seems like this is just the reality. People are human.
Yeah, and I didn't want to glorify policing because that's not what it's about either. Yeah. Is this guy is flawed and he is conflicted because he's brought up Catholic and he's trying to investigate this and he's not sure how this is going and he wants to solve this case because any good police officer who's investigating a file, the main goal is we want to solve this, we want to bring it to justice, and they want to give victims what they deserve, which is disclosure and to give them closure in the file and let them go on with their lives. So they do want to do that. And the doctor is also flawed. Like any emergency room doctor, he's exhausted and he is trying to do his best. He's got an overload of files and now this new disease is out there. So they're all flawed characters, but they're also hardworking and they represent different areas of society. Talking about, you mentioned about ideas, like there's not a lot of new ideas. And I remember one time, because I did journalism, and I remember one of the teachers saying, you know, there's no such thing as new ideas. They're just rehashing of old ideas and different versions. And every book you read is some version of Romeo and Juliet. But
that's what language is.
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
And I disagree with that. And, you know, so when I wrote this book, I wanted an idea that had never been done before. I wanted victims to read this book and go, yes, why can't this be real? And I wanted pedophiles to read it and go, oh, darn, God, I hope this is not real.
But at the same time, unless you made up your own language and didn't tell it to anybody and published a book in your own language that nobody could read,
yeah. It's
going to be a little bit like we're human and we explain things through compare and contrast.
Yeah.
So you could say, I could easily say of yours, while it is very, very original, I've never seen this take on it before, you could easily say it's a Michael Crichton outbreak book meets CSI and meets Dr. House, like just like from the procedural. There's very few novels that you can't just break down. I find it really hard when you can't, though. Like there are some novels where it's like, I've read this great novel. Oh, really? What's it about?
But that's great that, you know, because there is so much rehashing of old ideas. You know, you watch TV now, you know, I feel like I'm in the 80s again because everything on TV are shows I watched in the 80s. And now I just read an article online that they're redoing Magnum P.I. with my God, let it die.
Roseanne got a reboot. Have you watched that?
No, I haven't.
I don't advise it.
No, it's just, you know what? I don't know why there's enough writers in Hollywood that you can't come up with new TV shows to entertain us. We're an educated audience and we want to be entertained. And at the end of the day, you know, when you come home from work and you sit down and you want to have a show that lightens your mood or keeps your mind intrigued, come up with some good ideas. Stop rehashing these old ideas. There are new ideas out there.
See, I don't think that's a writer's problem. It is in that, like, you want to get your new stuff out there.
Yeah.
But that's more a committee problem, because what ends up happening is, let's say you're at a TV studio and you're pitching your new fall lineup. If it fails, like, if you've got a brand new show that's never been done before and it fails, and you're putting your name on it, you're going like, hey boss, I think this'll work. If it fails, you failed. But if you're basing it on an old property that has a fan base, you can pull up data. You can go, okay, well, other 80s properties have been doing good lately. Transformers did great, Ninja Turtles did great, all this and all that. And you can kind of pull back so that if it fails, it's not you that takes the blame. You can go back and say, well, the numbers said it would work, so it was a safe bet. Like, the numbers take the hit, and you don't. It's this weird job protection, which I understand. I mean, you know, you want to protect your job.
At the same time, it's lazy, you know.
It's very lazy.
I just, Tom Selleck's 73 now. I just don't want to see him in short shorts.
I'm just waiting for the gritty reboot of Teletubbies.
Oh my God.
Like, when they come out with machine guns and then, like, again.
Yeah, sometimes it's renewing, sometimes it's regurgitating, and I think that, you know, some of these shows are just regurgitating the 80s, and I'm just waiting for, you know, shoulder pads and ridiculous hairdos, the Mount Pearl Curl coming back, and it's just...
At the same time, I did love TV in the 80s. There's something about pre-internet generation TV that's...
Well, that was when you really had to write. You really had to be talented. You know, you didn't just have to release a sex tape to be famous. Mm. That you actually had to be talented, and you had to work at your craft and hone your craft. And I think nowadays it's just whoever's famous on, you know, once Instagram comes down, there's a lot of people not going to be famous anymore.
Yeah, it is an issue. So I wanted to talk about getting back to Wormwood a bit, or Operation Wormwood, without comparing it too much, because you were talking about your writer's process and the serial killer thing you were talking about. You wanted to write a thriller, but, like, everything's a serial killer now. I ran into that same issue when I was doing my original series, which was a crime thriller / horror book set in a small town in Maine. I ran into a double issue. I tried to fix a problem and ended up creating a whole nother problem for myself, because what I didn't want was the Jessica Fletcher Buffy the Vampire Slayer thing, because both Jessica Fletcher, Murder, She Wrote, for our younger listeners, which ran for 11 seasons, which just is insane. Like, that Murder, She Wrote was on the air for 11 seasons, and nobody talks about it anymore. I'm like, but that's, you know, they still make books with Jessica Fletcher as the author.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. But anyway, so all those, every episode there was a murder and she would solve it. Hence the title, Murder, She Wrote. Mm-hmm. And then she would write a fictional book about the murder that she solved. But they all took place in the same small town. which just destroys your suspension of disbelief after someone's like, is there anyone left in this town?
No, I wouldn't want to go there.
What? I wouldn't live there. What's going on? And the same thing with Buffy the Vampire Slayer. It takes place in a very small town, and people are dying because they're getting killed by vampires. That's obviously more fictitious. But that it's a small, you know, like a mid-sized, not a city town. And after so many seasons of people, you know, being killed by vampires, it's like, how is there anyone even left? What's going on here? What is bringing more victims to this town? Like, the economy can't be that great in this small town that people just keep coming in to be killed. So when I was writing a horror novel that was based in a small town, I tried to fix that, where I made a focus of a few books, sex crimes, to solve that body count problem, which created an entirely new problem, because then after a few, like, you can only do that in a 10-book series, I've learned twice. When you do it the third time, people are like, what's wrong with you, Matthew LeDrew? Who hurt you? That's what it becomes. People start looking at you going like, what's wrong in here?
Yeah. Well, yeah. You know, Truman Capote said you can't blame the author for what the character says. And, you know, you got to go to that dark place sometime. And writing is a process. And it's sometimes I find, you just can't sit down at a computer and for, you know, a month and just keep typing and typing and typing until you got a book finished. Hmm. It took 10 years to write Operation Wormwood because I had to go through the process. I had to go through the career in policing to have the knowledge to be able to do that.
Yeah.
And which is why it makes the policing side of it so real, is because I've been
very
through
authentic.
This. So you had to have that real. And then I did a lot of investigative work. I talked to priests and interviewed them about that whole dichotomy of protecting children but believing in God. And so, and I interviewed them, and I interviewed people in the medical field. So I did a lot of research, which took a lot of years. And then you just write a chapter, and then you kind of go for a walk, and then you write the chapter again. And you, at the end of the day, you keep have to ask yourself, what is the goal? What am I trying to achieve here? And am I getting too crazy in it? And I've also had people come back and say, well, there should be a romantic aspect to it because,
no.
You know, and I said, no, this is not a romance. There's no characters here. I'm so sick of seeing that in crime thrillers, where every time a police officer, a male police officer, and a female doctor or journalist or whatever gets together, they have to sleep together. You don't have to sleep with your partner.
The perceived necessity of that plot element almost undermines that both genders can work together without that happening.
Yeah.
Like the fact that any time there are two partners or two people working together of two different genders in fiction,
yeah,
that needs to happen at some point, whether it be starting a relationship or a fling or a one-night thing or like a stress reliever or something like that. The fact that that has to happen every time diminishes, I think,
yeah,
like
which,
the role of the genders working together in police.
Yeah, which underlines the whole Me Too movement of you know, women can only be in a crime series if she's, you know, she's walking into some CSI show with, you know, 3-inch stilettos on and a miniskirt and her blouse undone to her waist, and now she's going to find that perfect hair follicle that's going to solve the crime. I've never seen a female police officer in 3-inch heels and a mini skirt going into a dark room with a flashlight. You know,
yeah.
You know? But it's crazy that, you know, I read a book by Daniel Steele, and every now and again I'll read one of these books just because they're easy to read and it just kind of keeps you going. And I read all the time, so I just read one of them. And one of the characters was a female police officer who was getting on this boat to interview this guy she suspected was an international art thief. And she's getting on a boat in 3-inch stilettos in a miniskirt. And I'm thinking, who gets on a boat in a, you know, obviously she's not a Newfoundland girl. And the first thing she does is undo her blouse before she sits down to talk to him because she wants to mesmerize him. And I think, well, what about her investigative skills that she spent years, you know, working on?
Yeah.
What? And it drove me crazy. And I said, I cannot have a female character. And in my next book I'm writing now, it's a female corporal in the RCMP. I would never have her undo her blouse to get answers from someone that she suspects is a criminal. It's so ludicrous these days that happens.
Yeah, it is ridiculous, and it's diminishing. It's ridiculous. I don't know. I don't know if I want to get into this, but at the same time, why not? We're here. There's also the problem of when you're writing thrillers, there's that old problem of female characters in fiction that writers seem like they've only got 3 plots that they can do with them. Like there's, you get assaulted, you get married, or you have a baby. Like those are the 3 things that writers seem to think can happen to women. And when I say writers, it's very weird because, like you said, that was the novel you were just referencing was a Daniel Steele novel.
Yeah.
And that, so it's not just male writers. It seems to be a plot contrivance problem more than an author problem, although you could definitely make the argument that the gender imbalance in the field of writing for many, many years, the previous turn of the century, created certain tropes, and now we're trying to escape that, and it's hard. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and it drives me crazy when it is a female author, because, you know, you can't ask for equality in everything, but still want to be a damsel in distress.
But is it fair? And this is, I hate that I'm on this side of the argument, but like, it does drive me insane when it's a female author, but But at the same time, another part of me goes, but is it fair to ask this person to change the paradigm? Like, you know what I mean? Like, is it fair to put all of womanhood on this one woman author? You know what
I mean? No, she has a template that works for her, and she has an audience that enjoys that. And there is an audience for that damsel in distress, you know, where Mikonki guy comes and saves her. That's always there. But it depends on what kind of a woman you are. I've never wanted to be a damsel in distress. I've always saved myself.
All right. Well, thanks for coming on again. For all of you, we'll be here again next week at 4:30 Newfoundland time or online at chmr.ca. Please tune in and we'll talk more about writing culture in Newfoundland.